China's Syria says the U.S. push to keep a border crossing in Idlib open is aimed at supplying terrorists with arms under the pretext of delivering aid. Iran launches the clinical trial of a Neder coronavirus vaccine days after authorizing the emergency use of its first domestically made jab. French people vote in the second round of local elections following a first round vote marked by a drubbing for President Macron's ruling party. World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Megdad says that the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Idlib aims to supply terrorist groups with arms and prolong the war.
This is another attempt to help terrorist groups and to provide them with all necessary materials to prolong the terrorist war against Syria.
In an interview with RT, Megdad also said that cross-border activities by the U.S. and Turkey are a violation of Syrian sovereignty. The aid is funneled from Turkey into northwest Syria in an arrangement authorized by the U.N. Security Council. A seven-year authorization will expire next month. A diplomatic standoff is expected between Western members of the Council, who back renewing the authorization, and Russia, which has threatened to veto any such move. The top Syrian diplomat called Washington's policy a pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country.
This is another attempt. If the Western countries are really careful about Syrian citizens, they should lift their sanctions, because these sanctions and what we call unilateral coercive measures adopted by Western countries and by the United States are killing the Syrian people. They are not allowing us even to import medical instruments, not to mention foods and other necessary materials for the protection of the lives of innocent Syrians.
Megdad also accused Western countries of killing Syrian people through their sanctions that are affecting 95% of the population. Syria has been in the grip of bloody insurgency since 2011. Idlib is the last stronghold of foreign-backed militants fighting to bring down the Syrian government. I talked to independent journalist and resistance activist Vanessa Bailey, and she says that the U.S. and its allies aim to sustain the terrorist enclave in Idlib that's effectively run by Al-Qaeda.
If we look at the fact that Bab al-Hawa, which is the last remaining crossing that is open, which is completely under the control of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which of course is effectively an Al-Qaeda rebrand, and Bab al-Hawa is a well-known trading post for HTS, which means that all of the humanitarian aid which enters Bab al-Hawa is seized by HTS and then sold at extortionate prices to the civilians under their control in the last remaining Al-Qaeda haven, which was described as the largest since 9/11 by Brett McGurk. And of course, Ambassador Jeffries, Mike Pompeo's point man on Syria, recently admitted that Al-Qaeda is a U.S. asset inside Syria. So it's very clear that the intention by the U.S. coalition to maintain the cross-border operations is to sustain the terrorist enclave in Idlib and to sustain the war against the Syrian government.
Now, thousands of members of Iraq's popular mobilization forces have held a military parade attended by Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The event was held at Camp Ashraf in the eastern province of Diyala. The military base was formerly occupied by American forces. The parade marked the 7th anniversary of the formation of the PMF. Weaponry, including tanks and rocket launchers, were put on display in the biggest demonstration of the PMF's military prowess. In an address, Prime Minister Khatami paid tribute to the sacrifices of the forces in fighting Daesh terrorists. The PMF was established after a 2014 call to arms by Iraq's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, to help defeat Daesh. Iran has launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine as part of the drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. The shot, dubbed Noura, has been unveiled at a public university of medical sciences in Tehran. Officials say that Noura is a recombinant vaccine. It can be easily mass-produced after completing clinical trials. The project, sponsored by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, is the result of 16 months of scientific research. Iran is working on several COVID vaccines. Earlier this month, the health ministry authorized the emergency use of an all-Iranian jab called Barakat. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, got the first dose of the vaccine on Friday. Thousands of people have rallied in London in the latest round of protests against coronavirus lockdown measures, demanding an immediate end to the restrictions. Police arrested a dozen people and confiscated items ahead of the demonstration, which also protested several other social issues. Meantime, Health Secretary Matt Hancock resigned following revelations that he violated coronavirus restrictions. The latest developments come as COVID-19 cases surge rapidly in the UK in the light of the emergence of the Delta variant. The country has recorded some 18,000 new infections, the highest daily rise since February 5th. It's also registered 23 deaths. The latest figures have pushed the UK's total confirmed cases to 4.7 million and the deaths to 128,000. Now from London, let's bring in our own site, Purza, and see what's going on there. Good to have you with us, site. Hopefully you're safe from this new variant that's wreaking havoc in the UK, but looks like people are sick and tired of all those lockdowns, despite the threat that's still there.
Certainly are, and we saw that frustration exhibit itself, Beirut, in the protests that we saw yesterday, more of those protests happening today, and also examples of people who have been fully immunized, the so-called double jab people, saying that they have come down with the illness. Two journalists that I know of, one a famous one, works for the BBC, has been saying that he came down with COVID-19 and that he had a very unpleasant bout of the illness. Wow. The answer to that by the guest that journalist asked was that the fact that he wasn't hospitalized was a testimony that the vaccination or the vaccine was working. So even if you're fully immunized, you're not really safe from COVID-19. You're right about the frustration, as I said, but then the really big news here over the past 48 hours has been the resignation, and prior to that, the affair that the health secretary, the familiar face of the whole thing, the man who really wrote the guidelines for social distancing, becoming the man who violated his own rules. A clear example, really, of what is commonly referred to as the Tory sleaze, the Tories being the Conservatives who are now in power and have the majority in Parliament. Matt Hancock did not really resign immediately. He thought that he could really ride out this storm that plunged his career in crisis because he had the backing of the Prime Minister himself, who faced a lot of criticism over an affair he had with that businesswoman. He said, Boris Johnson said, that the matter was closed, referring to the affair that Matt Hancock had with his former advisor, former lobbyist, and a longtime friend, Gina Calandangelo. A lot of criticism against the government as to why the Prime Minister did not sack or fire Matt Hancock and waited for him to resign. Also, it wasn't really the first time that Matt Hancock had faced so much pressure, a groundswell of pressure indeed, not only from members of the public, but also from members of the Conservative Party and, of course, opponents of the government in the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. A lot of criticism there, but pressure in recent weeks as well. We all recall the testimony by Dominic Cummings, a top aide, former top aide, to the Prime Minister, who said that Matt Hancock should have had resigned a long time ago for 15 to 20 reasons, including lying to everybody, and by that probably referring to the fact that the Secretary of Health had said at the in the early days of the pandemic that there was enough PPE for the healthcare workers to protect themselves against the virus at a time when those same healthcare workers were wrapping themselves in dustbin liners to really avoid catching the virus as helped the hundreds and thousands of people who had come down with the illness. A lot of questions are being asked. Dominic Cummings, if you recall, went on to publish WhatsApp messages in which the Prime Minister himself had called his health secretary, Matt Hancock, now former health secretary, totally hopeless. A lot of other questions being asked as to why, whether or not the government adhered to protocol in hiring Gina Colodangelo on taxpayer money. She was appointed to a job that was funded by the taxpayers. Why he was not fired over, again, PPE and the failure of the multi-billion dollar track and trace system, among other reasons. There's also this other concern that has really enraged everybody, and that is the apparent hypocrisy, again, at the heart of it all. Government officials setting the rules and then violating themselves. Dominic Cummings himself was one man who did that and created the huge brouhaha months ago. And the moral decline in public office is what some people are really concerned about. So he's out of the picture now. An investigation will be launched. The Labour Party has called for into how this lady, a married woman, that Matt Hancock had an affair with, who has, by the way, left his wife, we understand, as well, was hired into that position. He's been replaced now by former Chancellor Sajid Javid, who really has a tough task on his hands. The pandemic is still very well here, and as you said earlier, the number of infections rising as a result of the so-called Delta variant first found in India, right. Although hospitalizations and deaths are still low. So tough days ahead for this government, for this new health secretary, and more humiliation for the government whose health secretary has been embroiled in this really immoral affair.
Okay. Thank you so much for that thorough explanation. Said Kuru is up in our London bureau. Now, the coronavirus pandemic continues to spread fast around the globe, with the global cases surpassing 180 million. Total number of fatalities from the respiratory diseases also nearing 4 million. Tunisia has recorded 4,600 cases, the highest daily tally. Thailand has announced new restrictions in and around the capital, Bangkok. Meantime, Brazil's health ministry reported over 64,000 new daily cases and nearly 1,600 deaths. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and the second highest death toll following the U.S. Now let's now turn to France. People there are heading for the polls to cast their ballots in the second round of regional elections. The first round results saw a drubbing for President Macron's ruling party, disappointment for Marine Le Pen's far right, and a record low turnout. The results put Le Pen's National Rally Party ahead in just one region. There were also cross-party concerns over the low turnout for last week's polls, which were shunned by nearly 67% of voters. Some observers believe that the outcome of the first round of the elections has raised doubts over whether the 2020 presidential election would come down to a duel between Macron and Le Pen in a runoff long seen as the most likely scenario. For more information on that, let's go to Paris. Kristen Hondon, correspondent, is there, and he's watching all those Syncotech with us, Chris. So what's expected to happen this time around? Last time we had this, nearly 70% of the voters just said forget about the polling stations. Now, what about this time?
Well, what I feel around me, there will be certainly not more people who are going to vote. So there will be, again, a record low turnout today. If that's the case, we can already now make some 3-4 major conclusions, because it will not move a lot compared to what happened last week. So there will be no major breakthrough for the far-right Marine Le Pen party, who is a really Islamophobic and a racist party. She arrived first in the southeast region around Marseille, but if today it's only elections between two candidates, so between her and the another right-wing candidate, so all the others are gathered around the second round, so it's almost improbable that Marine Le Pen will win one region in France. The second, the third, if you want, major conclusion is the major blow for the Macron party. So he really did not arrive, not first and not even second in any of the regions. This is historically, because not any presidential party that happened never in the history when a presidential party went to the elections. So the Macron party is marginalized. And people say that he has been sanctioned for his inexperience and his incompetency of his team, the government team. So it's a major blow for the Macron party. And the other conclusion that can be made is that the traditional right and the traditional left parties are not collapsing. So it could be a result today that the parties who kept the regions, who managed the regions, will stay in power. So traditional right, they will have like 5, 6, 7 regions, and the traditional left will also have 5, 6, 7 regions. So no big moving of the political spectrum. And as you said, one of the most important conclusions could be that there will maybe not be a duel in the next upcoming presidential elections, mm-hmm. because everybody, all the polls, predicted a duel between Macron and Marine Le Pen, but if it's confirmed today, what happened last week, this duel is not so sure anymore.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Kristen Hondon, correspondent in Paris. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The followers of the remembrance, if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio. with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today we're going to be examining the topic of prophethood. Specifically, we want to speak about the necessity of prophethood. We're not talking about prophethood in general. We're not speaking about the prophethood of a specific prophet, such as our prophet, the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Right now we're speaking about prophethood in general. Why should there be prophecy? Why should there be prophethood? Why should God send the divine revelation? In some of our previous sessions, we said that human beings are naturally social beings. They come together to form societies. The reason for this was that no human being can individually fulfill all of its needs. It's impossible. Rather, in order for it to continue its existence, human beings have to distribute labor amongst themselves. And in order for this to occur, they have to come together, live together, and form societies. With the formation of societies, conflict arises, a conflict of interest. Every human being in society naturally, for the same reason that he came to society, which was that he wanted to his existence to continue, his life to be sustained in this world, for that same reason, which was the love of himself, a conflict of interest occurs in society. Each human being tries to secure his own needs, sometimes to the detriment of others. Obviously, the material world is such that sometimes conflicts of interest occur. For example, one person wants to live in a certain place. Obviously, another person also wants to live in that place. And this place that all of these people want to live in can only sustain one human being. This conflict of interest arises. So there has to be some way to prevent this from occurring. The way that human beings have decided to prevent this is by means of a law. The question arises as to who this law, who should be the being that forms this law. In our last session, we examined the fact that the person or the being forming this law should be a being that's aware of the various dimensions of the person or the being that he's forming the law for. In the case at hand, this is the human being. Today, we want to look at another point, and that is that the person forming this law or the being forming this law should be a being that doesn't benefit from the law himself. And this is very obvious because we said that the main problem for why we said human beings themselves couldn't form this law was that each person would form the law in such a way that it was to his benefit and the same problem would occur. So this being other than human beings who wants to form this law should also not have any self-interest in the formation of this law. He shouldn't have any connection to it. Rather, it should simply be for the benefit and the felicity of the society itself. Now, when we look at and examine the situation, we see that the only person and the only being that has this condition is God Almighty, because he is the only being who is self-sufficient and is not in need of anything. This is because he is perfect. He has everything that every possible perfection, that every conceivable perfection. He has infinite knowledge, infinite wisdom, infinite power, infinite life. And all of his attributes are at the height of perfection. And therefore, and at the same time, it's impossible for him to change because he's not a physical and material being. So there's no way that anything could harm him in any way. So the formation of this law is not in the interest of such a thing, because simply for the fact that he's perfect and he has no need, he's self-sufficient, and therefore he is the best being that we can consider for the formation of the law, and that's why this law should be formed by him and he should send it in the form of prophecy and prophethood in the form of a divine revelation. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining prophethood and its necessity, as well as the necessity for the divine law. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part, we witnessed how 3 decades after the horrific nuclear disaster, Chernobyl is now showing signs of life again, as the industry is beginning to restart in Chernobyl, and every day, Cafe 10 is filled with tourists who have come to see the famous reactor. Chernobyl's Cafe 10, in the heart of the exclusion zone, is very much a traditional cafe in the most toxic region on Earth. Stay with us as we explore the intoxicated town furthermore and try to understand why so many people are fascinated to come and visit.
By late afternoon, tourists who were still in the area return to the cafe. At dusk, exterior doors are locked. In the area, a curfew is in place until morning. Pripyat and Chernobyl were the two main cities, but there were also many villages. The most radioactive ones were bulldozed and buried. Those that remain are the prey of metal looters. The metal is often radioactive to the extreme, especially when it comes to tools or vehicles that were used during the liquidation. Houses and apartments have been robbed. Everywhere. Radiators, power lines, cars, and even military equipment has disappeared. Some clandestine trucks were arrested, but the majority crossed the checkpoints unmolested. Corruption is widespread, and the government says it's helpless. In 30 years, 6 million tons of radioactive metal have left the zone. That makes 548 tons per day. This metal goes to foundries in eastern Ukraine that are then sold on the Chinese market. The Chernobyl radioactive metal can be found today all over the world in the most ordinary objects. Only churches and memorials seem to have been spared. Looters haven't passed through this kindergarten yet. Radioactivity is still very strong. But thieves don't care. They'll come and cut every centimeter of metal without wearing any protective equipment. These men often live in precarious conditions and don't care about risking their future health. The Ukrainian generation born after the disaster perceives the situation from a different angle. Many have already come to the area, but virtually, through video games like Call of Duty or Stalker that take place around the plant and Pripyat. Elina is part of this generation. She's a translator and comes regularly to the area. The story of the drama is alive, but the emotional memory of those who lived through it gradually fades away. Ivan and his wife Maria are Samosioli. This is the name given to those who have returned to live clandestinely in the area after the disaster. Most of them are sick, and their numbers decrease from year to year. They live in near autarky, and when we ask them why they return to live in the Forbidden Zone, their answer is simple. Their life is here. Other Samosioli work collecting metal abandoned by the army. Whole fields of irradiated military equipment has disappeared. The men paid dearly for a few $100. Ivan never participated in the dismantling, but nevertheless, he was exposed to high doses of cesium. The human body does not adapt to radiation as easily as nature. The most resistant animals are insects. And even though many of them died in the beginning, they've gradually adapted. In some species, close to 60 generations have passed, while man is still in his first. If some animals in the area have grown to impressive sizes, it is only because of the absence of humans. Among the regulars of the area, Misha is a regular customer at the cafe. He works for the city of Chernobyl and allows access to the different sites. Despite the reassuring speech of the authorities concerning radioactivity in the city, the 30-kilometer zone is strictly prohibited for pregnant women and children under the age of 18. The Lenin plant lies between Chernobyl and Pripyat. It is the heart of all concerns. The old sarcophagus, hastily built around the remains of reactor number 4, is no longer sealed. Some gaps are large enough to drive a car through them. Recently, the building structure became unstable, and scaffolds were built to prevent its collapse. To delay the threat, a gigantic arch is under construction. It is mobile and will cover the entire plant. For the moment, it is impossible to decontaminate and treat highly radioactive substances present in reactor number 4. The arc is expected to last 100 years. From now on, we must invent, fund, and implement an eventual solution. Novarka, a consortium between the Bouygues and Vinci companies, is the firm in charge of the work. It employs between 1,000 and 1,200 people each day on the site. For people in the region, these job offers are a fantastic opportunity. Their health is not their priority. Since the year 2000, all engines have stopped, but people are still working right inside the plant. There is a round-the-clock surveillance. At 10 meters high, a gigantic corridor that is over 1 kilometer long goes through the entire length of the building. It's called the Golden Corridor. It leads to the strategic places of the plant. At the end of the corridor lies the terrible reactor number 4 that exploded. The equipment used in construction seems surprisingly rudimentary. Most doors and door frames are made out of wood, and the mosaic floor moves and falls apart when you walk on it. The Lenin plant was nevertheless known to be one of the safest and most modern of the former USSR. Despite the dangers, the plant was kept in business after the disaster. The decision to completely shut it down was only made in December 2000. The other reactors had become too threatening. It is from post number 4 that operators handled the situation 30 years ago. We now know that the center had some design flaws. But if the explosion occurred, it is because of human error. Chernobyl is not unique. The oldest plant of this type is located in Leningrad, Russia. And we discovered that in 1975, a similar incident had occurred. The accident was less important than here. There are still 10 plants using this style of technology worldwide. The equipment is completely outdated, and the situation is distressing. The real wealth of the plant are the people working there. They have devoted themselves, body and soul, waiting for the arrival of the new sarcophagus. The chief operating officer of reactor number 2 has been working at the plant for 28 years. He's Russian, and his colleagues are Ukrainian, the common goal being primarily to prevent another tragedy. The authorized dose for nuclear workers is 20 times higher than for an ordinary citizen. If we go deeper into the core of the plant, towards reactor number 4, the passage suddenly darkens. Corridor is narrow and damp. The walls are peeling. The dosimeters are creaking continuously. In the cooling air passages between reactors 3 and 4, most accesses have been processed. Yet radioactivity is extremely variable, and where the worn-off linoleum exposes the concrete floor, the measures are very high. This big white wall is a sarcophagus built after the disaster. A memorial has been erected in honor of Valery Kodemshuk, the first victim of the explosion. Here, radioactivity in the air is 16 microsieverts. In other words, 160 times above normal. Behind the red door, less than 20 meters away, is a corium, also called elephant foot. This is a highly toxic and radioactive magma. It destroys everything in its path. Its temperature of 2,500 degrees does not decrease in contact with air. It will remain radioactive for 250,000 years. It kills all those who approach it in less than 5 minutes. Before exiting the plant, one must pass a security checkpoint that measures radiation. But is the machine really working? The guide says it hasn't beeped in 30 years. A wall in memory of the liquidators was built just outside the entrance of the enclosure. Between 600,000 and 800,000 people have worked to decontaminate the site. They were volunteers and considered that their involvement was part of their duty. Without them, the Chernobyl disaster would have severely contaminated all of Europe. In the end, 250,000 people were evacuated and hundreds of villages were wiped off the map. Tonight, there's no curfew in Chernobyl. Once a year, the city lets the liquidators' families come in for a few hours. They all lost someone and are often sick themselves. Emotions are contradictory. We're guilty for surviving, but happy to still be alive. The families of the survivors have rebuilt their lives outside the area. Radiation has affected their health and that of their young children. But what about the next generations? In Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine, doctors have found dramatic increases of malformations, leukemia, and cancer in children born just after the disaster. Even today, many cases of malformations are detected. They affect the vital functions of newborns and are more difficult to detect. 30 years have passed, and man is back in Chernobyl. When we start leaving the zone, the cafe appears to be the first step towards reclaiming contaminated soil. What could be more reassuring than a simple cafe to imagine that we could live here like anywhere else in the world? We can now work, sightsee, have a drink with friends, or enjoy a country house in Chernobyl. The explosion of the plant had terrible human, ecological, and also economic consequences for Ukraine. 2011, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych declared that he wants to resume farming on irradiated land, even within the prohibited zone. The undeveloped area is the size of a country like Luxembourg. In addition, the United Nations launched a development and rehabilitation program for the affected areas of Chernobyl. A new step has been taken. So we will perhaps soon have irradiated products from Chernobyl in our food chain.
Despite the bustling cafe and enthusiastic tourists and the elderly residents, the fact is that Chernobyl will remain contaminated for many, many years to come. The accident in Reactor 4 on that tragic day in April 1986 has left an eternal mark on the region to an extent that this region can never truly recover from its past. And that's it for this week. Join us next week for another Aperture. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salam alaikum, brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and here is Batool. Welcome to the program for a better life. In our previous session, we posed this question as to what is a better life. Then we came to the conclusion that a better life is when a person is happy. This happiness is not the material happiness, but it is the happiness of the soul. So how can I reach this happiness? It is when I become a better person. Therefore, to have a better life, I need to be a better person first. In the last session, we were talking about the steps to become a better person. And the first step was yaqda, which means to awaken. Sometimes a short sentence from a pious one can awaken us and change our lives. In the previous session, we were talking about what Abu Basir had narrated about his neighbor who was indulged in sinning. When Abu Basir talked about his neighbor to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, Imam said, "Tell him, if he stops sinning, I will guarantee the paradise to him." Wonderful lines, brothers and sisters. Abu Basir, he continues saying, "When I returned back to Kufa after completing Hajj, people came to see me, including my next door neighbor. After exchanging greetings and inquiring about my trip, when he wanted to leave, I asked him to wait. When other people left my house, I said to him that I mentioned your problem to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and he replied that upon your return to Kufa, that man will come to see you. Tell him that Ja'far ibn Muhammad said, 'Quit sinning and I will guarantee paradise.'" Now this short message of Imam touched this neighbor's heart. He started crying, and then he asked Abu Basir, "Do you swear by God that Imam said these words for me?" Abu Basir replied, "I swear by God." And then he assured him that these are the exact words of Imam for him. The neighbor said, "These words are enough for me." He said these words and he left Abu Basir's house. Then Abu Basir continues. He says, "For several days I did not hear from him. One day he sent a message asking me to visit him. So I went to his house. He opened the door but was hiding behind the door. Then he said, 'O Abu Basir, everything which I collected through haram, I have returned it to its owner. Right now, I possess absolutely nothing, not even a pair of clothing to cover myself, and that is why I am standing behind the door. I quit all sins and have truly applied Imam's message in my life.'" Abu Basir continues, he said, "I was indeed happy to learn about his repentance and changed condition and wondered about the impact of Imam's short message upon him. I returned back to my house and arranged for some clothing and some food and brought it for him. After a while, he again called me, and when I went to see him, I found him sick."
Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
He remained in this condition for quite some time, and during this period, I frequently visited him to take care of his needs. But unfortunately, his condition continued to deteriorate day by day, till one day I found him struggling between life and death. While I was sitting on his side and he was taking his last breaths, he suddenly opened his eyes and said, "O Abu Basir, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam has fulfilled his promise." He said these words and closed his eyes forever. Then Abu Basir continues, "After some time, I had the opportunity for going to Hijaz for Hajj and also to see Imam al-Sadiq. When I was about to enter his house and my one foot was inside his house while another was still in the yard, the Imam said, 'O Abu Basir, I have fulfilled the promise for your neighbor, and the paradise which I had guaranteed for him was bestowed upon him.' So this is how a single sentence can change a person's life. Brothers and sisters, to have a sentence affect our lives, we first need to open up our hearts, to be ready to accept advice, to be ready to implement it in our lives. If my heart is closed, nothing is going to seep in. Just like an empty bottle, if I close the lid tight and throw it in the ocean, the water is not going to enter the bottle. Similarly, if I close my heart to guidance, then it is not going to enter my heart. I need to open up my heart to let the advice have an effect on me. There might be tons of ulamas, tons of pious people around me. If I lock my heart, their words will have no effect on me. No effect at all. So as I said before, I need to open up my heart. That is when their advice will have an effect and bring that change in me, will make me a new person, will have an effect in me, and all my actions will become godly. My intentions will become godly. The way I think, the way I talk, the way I walk, the way I see, everything will be godly. And this will lead to me becoming a better person. So look, brothers and sisters, just one sentence from the Imam, and it changed his life. We might not have the Imam around us, but there are so many pious people around us who really practice what they say. And if they say something, and if I listen to it, it will have an effect on me. With this, I would like to end this session. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
It's all I need.
Is all I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.